You can probably think of a few relationships in your life that were just not equal. That's going to happen, but a power imbalance does not have to stay imbalanced. That's the key message in a new book about power dynamics between people. The book talks about adjustments that can be made and how. It is called The Power Manual, How to Master Complex Power Dynamics. It is the work of Cindy Suarez, who has a wealth of experience working with nonprofit organizations and social movements. She's the senior editor at the journal Nonprofit Quarterly and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Cindy, welcome.
Thank you.
You write that you first wanted to write this book as a teen. What motivated you then, and what finally got you to write it now?
Oh, wow. Yeah, I think just where I grew up in Boston, I grew up in Roxbury, which is a historically black neighborhood. And, you know, Boston's a pretty segregated city. And in a day, I would go from my home, which my family is from Puerto Rico, and I was born here, but my family was Puerto Rican. So I had a culture in my home that was slightly different than the culture in my community that was slightly different from the culture in the city. So in a day, I pretty much walked through at least three different spaces where I had to adjust how I behaved and how I perceived and how I interacted. So I think it was just part of me surrounded by it. And I think I had looking back now, I had an eye for that kind of dynamic and a fascination with the transitions and the kind of skill that it takes to live that way. And I think why I wrote it now, I mean, I think I always knew I would write it later in life. And I felt that, you know, after working in the social movement and nonprofit sector space for you know, probably two decades now, that it was the right time. I think I was just really, I'm a learner, and I really just spent lots of time studying this, working with concepts, study, you know, the theory behind it, the practice, the challenges in actual organizations that are trying to shift, the world, different challenges that the world is facing. And I felt that I just had enough at a point to write, and I think I also felt like I needed this book for myself. I needed to make sense of all those thoughts and all those experiences.
People do take advantage of difference, it seems like you're saying in the book. In fact, you say difference is a key for power dynamics. Is it as simple as things like, you know, male, female, older, younger, those sorts of differences?
You know, I think it depends on how people perceive difference. I think, you know, one of the things that, one of the frameworks in the book that talks about how this is developmental, our ability to encompass more and more differences is a key aspect of our development. So I think it depends on where people are and how they define difference. But yeah, there are the ones that we know of, which are what I consider the basic structures of domination in our society, like racism, sexism, classism. Those are the things that we have language for, that we have concepts for, and can talk about now. But I think that it's everywhere. And in working with the Black Lives Matter movement, for example, which was one of the first times that I worked in a movement that was purposefully mostly all black. And I saw the differences that arose in that space and just how they were just as vibrant and alive as any other types of differences that I see in other more explicitly accepted identities. So I see it everywhere, and I think that it's what got me to the conclusion at the very beginning that the main trigger for power dynamics is a perception of difference.
And so you're surprised sometimes by how people don't get that, because, I mean, growing up, as you mentioned, Puerto Rican family from a black neighborhood in Boston, getting involved with groups like Black Lives Matter. I mean, you're with people who understand what it is like to be considered different and therefore on the lesser end of a power dynamic, or at least that's where people assume they want you to start. And I just wonder if you are often surprised by people who just don't see it that way. They're just not aware of it because it hasn't happened in their lives the way it happened to you.
You mean people who are not in those spaces that you just mentioned?
Right.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because those spaces can actually be really diverse. And I've actually worked in, you know, organizations that are predominantly white when I'm mostly in foundations and in consulting spaces. So I've worked all across those types of, I think there are spaces where people are mostly people of color, and there are a lot of spaces that are diverse. And I'm not surprised because it's how things are in a way designed. It's, you know, it's the world when there is a status differential around race, then the people that are at the top are not going to perceive it as much because it doesn't affect them. I myself see it as a person who's pretty educated, who in my neighborhood would be considered pretty high income. I live in Roxbury still. And, you know, there are many ways in which I'm perceived as having high status in some of the spaces that I am in. So I think having those experiences, especially as I got older and I was able to create more access for myself and move in different worlds, I see how easy it is to, for example, if you're a citizen, to, it wasn't until my first marriage to a non-citizen that I realized what it's like to not be a citizen. So there are so many different ways that we all are, it's easy for us not to see those things that advantage us. It's easy for us to think that those are things that we earn or that we are entitled to not even think about it, really.
To not consider the privilege, in other words.
Right.
Right. This isn't just a book about you, I need to point out here. You weave a bunch of different strands together in here, and I just wonder what kinds of things helped you assemble all the different strains of thought in this book.
Yeah, well, this is a really fascinating process. I began for about a year before I even started writing. I began by looking at all the different frameworks and thinking and theories that influenced me throughout my life. And then I sort of designed the book beforehand. I selected key theories that I wanted to build on and explore. And I mapped them. I spent weeks with each particular piece of writing, and I mapped those into mind maps. And so I kind of spent a lot of time really mapping out my ideas, and then I began to write about maybe 18 months later. And I think that a combination of looking back at all these things that really influenced me, all these theories and practices, and also seeing the new developments, keeping pace with what's happening in the world now around these different dynamics, really helped me weave together something that started to make sense. And some of it evolved. So the first three sections of the book, I initially had conceived of those as the core of the book. And then I started to write a fourth section. I started to write a second book, which became the fourth section on games. The first book was mostly, which the first three sections are mostly about thinking and practices and theories, and then the last section is the games.
All right, so we have identity. Let me just tell our listeners, because we're getting close to a break here, identity, choice, and thresholds, the first three sections of the book, and then games, as you just mentioned, the last section of the book. So off to a break, and we'll begin to get into those in further depth when we come back. We're talking to Cindy Suarez about the Power Manual, back on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Cindy Suarez. She is the senior editor of the journal Nonprofit Quarterly, has a wealth of experience working with nonprofit organizations and social movements, organizer extraordinaire, and an author now with a book called The Power Manual, How to Master Complex Power Dynamics. It's about finding ways to adjust the balance of power in relationships that need that adjustment. You can join the conversation on the exchange, share stories from your own life, perhaps, or ask questions of our guest. 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Cindy, there's a really interesting phrase you use up front in the book about social change agents use the same power frameworks and tools that the dominant use. So get our feet wet there. What kinds of frameworks and tools are we talking about?
Well, basically dominant ways of interacting. The book centers on interactions and looks at all the other things, structures of domination, organizations, institutions, as artifacts of our interactions. So in looking at interactions, it really became clear that that was the place where we could enact, like, change a power dynamic. And when I looked at that, I saw that, you know, it comes from the theory and from the thinking around that. And so when I found that there was actually a framework on patterns of interaction that are dominant, from Roland Barthes, who wrote about those as supremacist consciousness, I shift a little bit of the terms to make them a little bit more accessible, but the blend of theory can be obtuse. So the patterns of domination, when you looked at the different patterns, of which, you know, he identifies seven, and they're all based on our ability to integrate or not integrate difference. And when you looked at that, you could see easily that was something that everybody did. And it wasn't something that I found, actually. Chela Sandoval, who actually wrote a book called Methodology of the Oppressed, through which I discovered Roland Barthes' framework, was the one that identified that. She said, this is something that everyone does, including social change agents, because these ways of interacting are so acceptable. They're actually considered the right way to interact. For example, one of those patterns is tolerance. Tolerance is the ability to accept small doses of difference.
All right, I was really surprised to find tolerance in there as a pattern of domination.
Right. And that's what makes all of these so powerful, that they are considered valid ways of being, if not the ideal way of being in a sort of democratic society. So tolerance, assimilation, the incapacity to see difference. So these objectivity, the ability to ignore or the propensity to ignore power-laden realities, these are all, they're not bad qualities. They're qualities that people think are either neutral or preferred. So when you have power working like that, like working at such a core, at the level of assumption, then everyone practices it. That's what we're taught. It's the unspoken rule that we all learn to be in society together. So that's how we all end up doing it. And I think it's why we all have to be aware, not just the people who aren't part of these worlds that you speak of, that I'm part of, but even those that are.
And so within those patterns of domination, we mentioned tolerance and assimilation. It's also objectification, authority, objectivity, accumulation, and certainty. Patterns of resistance include sign reading, deconstruction, and reconstruction, which gets us to a more general sense here from what you say, that liberatory power is real power as opposed to supremacist power. So how, for example, does a person exercise liberatory power over a person or body using the other kind?
Well, I think the first step is knowing that there's a difference. I've gotten a lot of feedback from people in the sector and social justice movement, folks who've told me, wow, this is something that's really helpful. So I think just the idea that there are two different types of power help one to decide which is the one you were pursuing. Up till now, honestly, there hasn't been language for this. I have worked in the sector for 20-plus years, and that isn't the way that we talk. And I've specialized in places that focus on power. So now you really see how there just isn't a lot of language for it. And, so seeing it, and then, that's why the fact that these frameworks are simple and that people can actually use them, and the language that I use is language that everybody uses. So I think what I've learned and what I've heard from people who are already using this is that it's really easy in an interaction, once you have that framework in mind, to see when something is going wrong, and to understand what it is, and then to know what to do next, to have an idea of what to do next to shift that.
Go ahead.
Well, so that's the whole point of it, is knowing that and practicing it.
All right, so being prepared for situations in which you might have to implement some of the tools you got.
Right. Well, just having that awareness, just having those tools in your mind. You may not have, at the beginning, there's no practice. You start and you just start to, like, you remember that there is this framework and you start to use it. And so it's just a matter of practice. And after a while, it becomes pretty second nature. And you start to feel really powerful. And at the same time, not like you're dominating, which is the magic of it. You start to sort of walk that fine line. That's actually really beautiful, to be able to build your power in a way that helps you and others.
That's a really important point, though. The point of getting rid of somebody else's domination is not to instill your own.
Right. Right. And I think that's one of the core, I mentioned in the book that these different approaches to difference come from a really core place of abundance versus the idea of that there isn't enough for everyone, that power is limited. If power isn't limited, it's not a material thing. It's a dynamic that we create and amplify and can share. And so once we learn that we can do that, it's actually like a whole world opens up, both in terms of what you can imagine for yourself, but what you can create with others. When something happens in an interaction, someone comes at you with a power dynamic, which is based on this idea that if you have something they don't, then you can choose to either, fight back, to not engage it, or to try to find a way to redirect it. And those all take different levels of engagement and energy, and there's choice. So I'm really, after writing this book for 5 years, I've seen how much it changes my life. I've seen how conscious I've become of how I expend my energy.
Cindy Suarez is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is The Power Manual, How to Master Complex Power Dynamics. Cindy, there's a story in here about a woman, just in terms of, real case studies, there's a story in here about a woman canvassing for a candidate who gets into conversation with a woman supporting the other candidate, which I just found fascinating, because what would you say were the keys to that conversation where they actually ended up listening to each other?
Yeah, that happened to me. Well, that was a really amazing experience, and it happened, over 10 years ago, and it was such a small thing, and I remember it to this day because it really highlighted for me the way I'm implicated in any of these dynamics. So that was a day that I was, I used to work for a political strategy center, and it was in the Northeast, and at this point I was traveling to a different city to help a candidate that was running for office, and it was, the last few days of the election, and pretty much I was given an easy task, which was to canvass for 2 hours in a neighborhood that was already known to be voting for him. So I had a pretty uneventful 2 hours. It was a nice fall day, and I just walked around. No one was home. I kept sticking the flyers in the doors and talking to the occasional person that was home. And at the very end of my shift, I was about to turn on the main street going back to the office, and I see this one house that I hadn't gone to, and the people that lived there were just pulling up in a pickup truck, and it was a family, a mom, a dad, and a little two-year-old. And they were white, and I remember the woman came over to me, and I remember, I'm going to have to talk to her because I was really about to wrap up my shift. So she came over to me, and she waved me down, and she said, are you working for, and she named the candidate because she was working for the challenger. And she wanted to engage me in things that she had heard from her candidate about the candidate that I was supporting. And I listened to her talk, and I noticed immediately how tense I felt in my body. I almost wanted to flee away from her, mostly because she was using terms and frameworks and values, not values, frameworks and ways of talking about this that seemed really different than the people that I'm used to talking to. So immediately I saw that, oh, wow, I'm in a bubble. I'm talking to someone who looks at things really differently, and I'm having a reaction to that, a really intense reaction to that. So I sort of stayed there and listened to her, and she was actually, I remember it was about immigration and about people who are poor milking the system, and she gave an example of a friend of hers who was doing this, and she pointed to her house, and she said her and her family worked really hard, and they did it the right way, and here they are. And so I thought about all these things that she was saying, and she was almost spitting because she was so convinced of what she was saying, and she had approached me with a little bit of animosity. And I just listened to her for a while thinking, how do I respond? This was even like years before I even wrote the book. And I remember I thought, oh, what matters to her is family and fairness. And I said to her, and I had a child the same age as her son, and at the time, her father was exiled from the U.S. That was after 9/11, and he was from Sudan. And after everything that happened, he had to leave the U.S. And my daughter didn't have a father at that point. I was a single mom, and I worked really hard, and he had worked really hard, and we had done all the things you were supposed to do. I had multiple college degrees, so did he, and it didn't work for us. So I just, when she finished, I said, well, you know what? I'm really glad it worked for you. It didn't work that well for me. And I started telling her about my circumstances. I said, I have a two-year-old too. And I said, but she doesn't see her dad. And I told her what happened. And just that human connection, I just saw in her eyes like, I get it now. And she said, so you mean that my candidate is kind of like lying? And I said, yeah, a lot of the things he's saying, they don't reflect the reality of people that are actually going through that. And she got upset again, but this time at her candidate, because apparently she was a pretty top official in his campaign. And she said, you know what, I'm going to go back to the office, and I'm going to ask him about this, because that doesn't seem fair to me. And I remember I was elated, mostly because I had walked the edge and been able to find my way to connecting with someone. And it was just such a big moment for me. And I remember I walked back to the office. That was the highlight of my day, this ability to connect with someone that I really didn't understand how I could at the very beginning. And I told the people in the office the story, and they all just looked at me like I was crazy. And I remember the guy said, you're not supposed to talk to the enemy. And I remember feeling like, wow, that really impacted me. And it was one of the ways that I saw this othering and the same things that people in my movement were fighting for, they were very quick to do to the other people that they considered to be on the other side. So I just remembered that, just connecting with this person who I wasn't supposed to connect with and feeling really alienated from my team by their approach to a person and to a human.
Wow, so you actually were able to accomplish an identification of something more than otherness to the your opponent, and then your allies were the ones like, oh, yeah, those are the others.
Yeah, I mean, I was able to see where we connected as people, and I think that's the key.
Cindy Suarez is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is The Power Manual, How to Master Complex Power Dynamics, How to Change the Imbalance in Power Relationships. And most relationships have somebody with a little more power in them. You can join the conversation on the Exchange, share your story, ask your questions at 800-838-3760 on the phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Cindy, you talked about how you really walked the edge with the woman when you were out campaigning. And does this process often involve that, though? Is there some sense of, I don't know, psychic danger or something, if no more than that, when you do try to change power relationships?
Oh, yeah, I think so. Even to have to engage in power dynamics without attempting to change them. I mean, it is really, you're trying to name something that's very invisible, and you're trying to communicate across assumptions, and you're one of the parties. So your integrity in that really matters. And like I said, there's a lot of physical feelings that come along with perceived conflict. So there's a lot to manage, and I for myself, notice that. I pay a lot of attention to what goes on in my body and when I have those feelings. And a lot of the book is about this sort of embodied knowledge of these power dynamics as well, not only seeing it in interaction, but understanding how they track in our bodies and how to perceive that information we're getting from our body. Like I knew in that instance, I immediately recognized how I had gone from being calm at the end of this shift to being really on alert and actually kind of like not wanting to talk to this woman. So those dynamics show you how risky it is. Your body goes into fight or flight.
Yeah, and truly, and you managed to stick it out and got some great rewards as a result. So this obviously involves listening and figuring out where the other party is coming from. How much self-analysis does it require, too, to know where you're coming from when you get into a conversation with somebody about adjusting power dynamics?
It's core to it, but the second section really expands on that. And it's, you know, the process, there are different frameworks and tools to use, but the core process is to be able to tap into memory. So something happens, you have a memory that fits into or a past experiences, and you reflect, and you have choice around how you're going to act. So, for example, if you're in a situation where, for example, in that dynamic that we just talked about, I could connect what she was saying to me to my experience in the moment. I think what was great about that for me was that I could do it in the moment, and oftentimes you do it in retrospect. Like we had a tough interaction, we walk away feeling really ill at ease. Again, our bodies tell us, and we try to understand what happened, what went wrong. And so, you know, that idea of thinking about something, connecting it to what we know, which is the reflection part, and then making a choice about it. Either I don't like how I did that, and next time that happens, I think this is what I might do. Or I really like that I did that. Wow, I wasn't able to do that before. I've really come along in this part of my journey. So that's the core of all of the frameworks that I present, all of the practices, is this ability to pay attention, reflect, and have intentionality.
You know, I did notice that you said that choice does require attention, a limited resource. Ouch.
Yes.
Ouch for the human race that we're lousy at paying attention, it sounds like.
Yes. That was actually a really core, some of those ideas when I put them together brought me up to almost like crossroads, and, you know, because there's this perception that we should all just be this way. But the more I wrote this book, the more I realized how hard it actually is to be these kind of people that we want to be or that we expect others to be. And one of them was this revelation that choice is, and this is from the work of Kahneman and Tversky, who won a Nobel Prize for upending the theory of rational decision-making, with this idea that, no, we actually have two systems of making decisions. We have an automatic system that just kind of makes decisions for us, and those are our biases, are just, you know, most of what we do. And apparently, it's over 90%. And so you're not even aware of most of the choices you're making. I differentiate that in the book and call it decision-making because it's not intentional. And then the part where your mind actually gets triggered and makes you actually do make a choice where you're making a decision or comparing a set of options is very rare. And it's rare because it requires a lot of our energy. And our energy is essentially glucose. You know, we work, we live, we eat to build up our bodies, to have energy, to expand in the world. And it's in the form of glucose. And what researchers have found is that glucose is used up differently in different situations and at different levels of mastery. So if you're in a situation that requires thinking, that's actually, I believe, that's one of the highest uses of glucose. That's why you can study all day and not do any physical activity, but still need a lot of food. Even meditation, people think that meditation is a really simple, relaxing thing. It actually uses up a lot of your conscious energy, your glucose. So if our decision-making is mostly unintentional, how do we make conscious decisions about how to be with each other? That was the core question that stumped me when I got to that section and spent, you know, months reflecting on. And, you know, what I learned was that you can actually increase your range of choice the more you pay attention. So even though our bodies preserve our energy by making most decisions for us, we can actually choose. We can actually say, you know, when this happens, I'm going to start paying attention to this, and I'm going to try to do this. It seems really hard at the beginning when you first have an intention, but over time, you know, what I've learned is that a situation that I've been trying to change, I'll work on it for months or years, and then one day that same situation will happen, and I'll have a totally different reaction, the one that I wanted, and then I'll see that I've made progress. So that's how I see it happening. It's really, the focus is on the practice. You do get the rewards. You don't know when they're going to come. It's just one day all of a sudden it's become so much a part of who you are that you just don't react that way anymore. Move on to other intentions,
sure,
or other choices.
All about being prepared for it. That is certainly the case. That's what the Power Manual is about. That is Cindy Suarez's book. It is subtitled How to Master Complex Power Dynamics. We'll come back and talk more about how to even up a power imbalance in a relationship when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Cindy Suarez and you in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Cindy Suarez, who has about 2 decades experience in social movements and nonprofit organizations. She's the senior editor at the journal Nonprofit Quarterly and shares her expertise and things she's been thinking about since she was a teen in a book called The Power Manual, How to Master Complex Power Dynamics. It's about evening up relationships in which one party, intentionally or not, has seized the greater power and the ways in which the people who are on the other end of that transaction can even up the power. You can join the conversation on the Exchange, 800-838-3760, to share a story, ask a question, or make an observation. You can also send those by email to jx@jeffnet.org. I wanted to ask, before we leave the chapter on choice, Cindy, about how social groups affect choice, because you give an example in the book of people who, because the people around them, and in this case a child's family, assumed they just weren't fast learners, they believed that too. And somebody else who took them away from that group was able to prove that wasn't true.
Yes, and that gets into the social aspects of choice and our identity to power. So yeah, we are in a society that positions us. I mean, we may have a status that we prefer to play. Some people prefer to play low, some people prefer to play high, but also society labels us according to different categories and factors. And so, and also, by the way, we perform in expectations. So this child, it was a situation I observed, yeah, where a kid wasn't in a great school system that wasn't supporting his learning, and he was just considered not a good learner, and the family kind of gave up on him, and he had a person in his family that luckily was able to intervene, seeing that he hadn't had a lot of opportunity to become a good learner, and help turn that around a bit. So, but, you know, and part of it was, in observing their dynamic, was how the main part of the work for that family member was try to undo this thinking that this child had, that they themselves weren't a good learner. So if you grow up in a home and someone's telling you, or you hear people talking about you in front of you, and even if they're not saying things that are not, you know, considerate, but it's almost in everything that we say, we give an opinion about how we see another person, and that's where it becomes really important to be careful about our language and how we talk about other people, and especially in front of them. So yeah, I mean, that shaped him. It happens in workspaces where certain people are considered to not be up to the task. And there could be many reasons why that's the case. I was recently on a tour where there was a man giving a talk, and it was a tour through a city, and I couldn't understand what he was saying. At first I thought that he was an older black man. At first I thought I just wasn't hearing him well. And then when I moved closer, I realized he just wasn't speaking in complete sentences and standard sentences. And it was so extreme that I couldn't understand him. And that's when it dawned on me It was a really sad moment to see this is what happens when someone doesn't even get the opportunity to learn basic grammar. And that happens to a lot of people. People will judge people based on that. I often think of language as a currency. You know, how you speak and how you come across in the world tells people a lot about who you are. So, yeah, society shapes how we are able to access power.
And then there's a whole section of the book then after that where you move into thresholds, which it sounds like it's really about finding our personal thresholds and pushing beyond them, going beyond the limits that we believe that we possess.
Yeah. So the first section on identity, really what I learned was that how we position ourselves around power shapes everything. And then there is choice. But then my question at that point was, well, how do we exercise choice? What do we pay attention to? And what I found was that there are these thresholds. There are these moments in life where the way that we've done something thus far no longer works. And oftentimes, those are the moments where we are looking for some other way of being. And that happens in big phases in people's lives, and it also happens in day-to-day interactions. So every time you interact with someone that's different, you're, you know, trying to figure out how to be, and that's a threshold. So noticing what the thresholds are also, I mean, these thresholds have been theorized, by different people, specifically Victor Turner is who I turn to. But, you know, what we find is that thresholds are where the status quo has sort of disintegrated a bit and all the potentiality is there to be reformed. So they're actually really vibrant spaces that function differently than the more structured everyday space that's where things work as they should. So thresholds are really important spaces to understand and to understand when one is happening, how they function. There's actually a lot in the book about that. What are the roles? What are the features of those spaces? And how does one feel? What are the parts of thresholds? There are three phases. How do you come out of thresholds? So understanding that. I mean, I had a friend who was going through something where he really wasn't happy with where he was in his career anymore. And it really is that he wasn't being challenged anymore. He was trying to figure out how to what to do next. And he was feeling really bad about where he was. And I said to him, well, that's what happens in threshold space. Because as he described his situation, it matched the characteristics of what people that are in that space go through and feel like. And part of it is that they don't have status because what they thought and what they've been doing doesn't work anymore, either for them or for others. And so there's a lot that's different. And when I explained to him that this is what was happening and that this is actually a really important phase in his life and that he can really be in it in a different way and live through this space while he's in it, it changed his whole perception of that challenge to one where he could see the potential and to focus on that and to know what to do. So it's important to know those spaces.
So he saw it as, this is a frustrating part of my life, and you saw it as a real opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, this is the way he was describing it. I mean, some frustrations are just daily frustrations, but some of them are really major. Some of them, which are just when you are in this space where you just aren't happy anymore and you don't know what comes next, that in and of itself is the first sign that you're in threshold space. But then all the things he described about how he was feeling and what he was going through, what he was thinking, matched perfectly what I was writing, which I was discovering from the theory and the thinking that I was really delving into. And it was important to me to test these ideas out in time. So by sharing that with him and seeing his reaction and seeing how it shifted, how he then proceeded, I realized, well, it really is important. So my hunch was that this is important. It's important to understand this. And then I saw that. I saw that not only for me, but for other people understanding that. And I've gone through threshold spaces. When I made a shift from doing the kind of work you described to what I'm doing now, which is mostly writing, that's a big shift. I knew that I wanted to shift my work in the sector and in movement to the level of ideas, to really put into words and to language some of the things that I had been thinking about for the past two decades. That was a big shift to make. I spent years just not being attracted to any job that I was offered and just sort of feeling in my body this sense of like doom, I can't do that job anymore, even if it was running an organization, because I knew that just wasn't where my passion was. And so I had to sit with that for a long time. I mean, a career change is a pretty big one. Until I could start to see and tap into my true desires and what I wanted, to start to imagine a different me in the future. So, yeah, it's important. It's important to know that and to, and those spaces are really valuable. There are places where we are meant to experiment and to be okay with not knowing for a while.
Cindy, I want to ask about something else in this section of the Power Manual, the threshold section, the seesaw principle in status interactions. What is that?
Well, that comes from the world of theater. So one of the, and this is how it ended up being a fourth section, which was going to be a second book. But what I learned as I was finishing the book, and I really wanted to get more into the practical aspects of how to live this way, I was around the theater world because of my daughter. She's a theater student. And I saw that in theater, they use games to do everything. And I saw that a lot of the games were about status. And I became intrigued with that idea that there was a field that actually had explicit language for power exchanges and that taught actors how to move in and out of different statuses. And one of the games that they play is the seesaw game, which is, two people talking. And, and you can play this game in different variations, but you're basically saying something. So I say something, the other person says something back to me. So we're in a conversation, but we're conscious of saying something that either lifts and exalts that other person or puts them down status-wise. And what that does, and so you can either do it where both of you are putting each other down, where one's putting each other down and one's putting the other person up, or both up. So you kind of get to see how the everyday, almost neutral words we use actually are always conveying power, always conveying how we feel about another person. So those exercises, of which there are many in the book, are meant to help people understand how to point out power dynamics, how to learn to, when you mentioned the different strategies of resistance, the first one was sign reading. You need to understand what are the signs of power. And so that's a game that does that. And the book is divided that way. The games in the fourth section correspond to the different patterns of resistance. So games that teach you sign reading, games that teach you deconstruction, what is the relationship between the signs, what's the story there, and games that teach you how to reconstruct. How can you use those same factors to tell a new story?
All right, so I want to be really clear with our listeners. We are talking about games in which you do these as exercises, not actually playing games in a true power relationship, right?
Exactly. They're interaction games. They're acting games. They're games where we use our bodies and our language and everything that we do to actually show a status, to shift the status, to somehow engage a dynamic of power.
You know, you point out in the book, too, that play is very important to people. We do learn a lot from playing with each other, and even though some people might, think it's just frivolous time, not well spent. But the fact is you find a lot of value in play, and so do scientists.
Yeah, that was something that I actually backtracked into when I really discovered the power of games. I started to study games, and I quickly saw this whole field of play open up. And I read this book that was a key book in that field. And what it said was that when they were, first of all, the idea that there was a field about play was fascinating to me.
Yeah.
And the reason why it became a field was because they started to notice certain behavior in animals in nature. They saw, for example, that a really hungry wolf, for example, might decide to play with another animal that it was meant to eat if that animal manages to engage the wolf in play. And researchers thought, well, why would that be? Like, why would a hungry animal be convinced to play instead? And in this interaction that the book describes, it happened over time. So this animal continued to choose to play rather than eat the other animal. And what they found was that play has an evolutionary purpose. Play allows us it's central to adaptation. So it's valued inherently in nature, and it's inherently about power. So play allows us to test ourselves at that edge, to play with intention and rules towards a goal, and to understand how we're doing. And it makes the players engage each other. You have to engage the other person in order to figure out how to either beat them or collaborate with them. So, because there are collaborative games. So games inherently bond players. They also found that when players compete, even if they compete ferociously, after that competition, they like each other more than if they had not played together in a competition. So even when you're competing, you bond to another player. So it makes sense when you look at it in nature and in people. We don't have that as a concept yet, I think, in our society widespread. But what this author says is that we actually have a deficit of play. The fact that we don't play enough is what it contributes to power sort of bursting out in negative ways in all these other spaces. I remember as a young kid reading about different history, reading about different societies where they would have war games. And I remember thinking, why would anybody have war games? And all this started to make sense to me. how people use games to actually deal with power and to do it in a way that the rules are agreed to, that it's that can be negotiated, and that there's a sense of fairness.
So Cindy, you've given us a lot to think about in the book. I mean, once you know we're done and people move on with their days, what would be a good first move for people to use to think about reordering the power dynamics in their relationships?
Wow, that's a really good question. The first thing to do, I think people begin in different places, but I think one general rule could be just to start to notice what you're doing and what other people are doing to you. Start to look at patterns. That's a great way to start to gain an understanding of how you do power and how other people do power with you.
So in other words, monitor yourself and then look at the way that that you respond to other people and they to you.
Yeah, pay attention to what happens and see what you're learning from it. And really, it's to identify patterns, to see what you tend to do over and over again, because a lot of this works on patterns. We trigger each other. Somebody who's dominant may trigger another person to be subordinate, and it's easier for that person because that person has subordination readily available to them, where it may not be to someone else. So there are these dynamics happen in patterns, and so paying attention to, and they tend to repeat. They tend to repeat in your three spaces that I mentioned, in your family, at work, and school spaces.
All right, a whole lot to think about. The book is called The Power Manual, How to Master Complex Power Dynamics. It is the work of Cindy Suarez, who's been waiting to write the book since she was a teen. She finally got it out there. Cindy, congratulations, and thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
All right, take care.